Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we talk about South Africa. We talk about deep poverty, unemployment, inequality, and our attention was caught by this story that appeared in many publications. Let me read to you what the New York Times reported on August 16 of last week. From Marikana, South Africa, the police fired on machete-wielding workers engaged in a wildcat strike at a platinum mine last week, leaving a field strewed with bodies and a deepening fault line between the governing African National Congress and a nation that 18 years after the end of apartheid is increasingly impatient with deep poverty, rampant unemployment, and yawning inequality. In a scene replayed endlessly on television that reminded some South Africans of the days when the police of the apartheid government opened fire on protesters, heavily armed officers shot into a charging crowd of workers who walked off the job demanding higher wages. This hour of the program, Douglas Foster is our guest. Douglas is Associate Professor of Journalism at Northwestern University and author of the book that is going to be released on September 10. It is titled After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Douglas is the former editor of Mother Jones magazine, and he is formerly senior editor of the Center for Investigative Reporting, director of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. And he had access, as he put together this book, which we'll talk in some detail about once the book is released. We want to talk about the news story, but he, of course, has spent a great deal of time in South Africa interviewing many of the key players on today's scene, including the president, Mandela's family, and many, many others. We're going to be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. For you to join us. Douglas Foster, thank you so much for being with us.
It's good to be with you, Kathleen.
When you heard about the news and perhaps saw the news of what was happening in Marikana, South Africa last week, did it remind you of the days of the apartheid government opening fire on protesters?
The initial thing was I heard from friends that there had been a great tragedy at the Lonmin mine at Marikana, and it seemed at first report like a local event, even though 34 protesters were killed last Thursday. There have been a series of very violent strikes in South Africa over the period of 8 years while I've been reporting the book. But then the visual images brought a different message because those of us who grew up in the anti-apartheid movement, of course, remember the scenes of people shot in the back in 1969 in Sharpeville, the large-scale youth revolt in the 70s, and then the hugely militant strikes in the late 80s, which were central in bringing the apartheid regime to the negotiating table. So those images, I think, are what led people to immediately make the connection, although it's a strained connection in a way because there is one person, one vote democracy in South Africa these days, which in some ways makes the shootings, the killings, and the violence even more disturbing.
Are mine workers grossly underpaid?
Well, of course, if you've ever been in these deep shafts, you wouldn't imagine that any money was worth that kind of work.
Good point.
Compared to, I guess we have to say, what are we comparing it to? The formal rate of unemployment is 25.7% today. Probably three quarters of young black men do not work in the formal economy. So compared to those unemployed people getting along in the informal economy or living on the margins, they are well paid. Compared to miners in many other parts of the world, poorly paid. And these particular workers who took a wildcat action are 3,000 workers at the mine out of a total workforce of about 25,000. They're the rock drill operators who do some of the most difficult work. It's actually quite skilled work. I think this has been misreported as the group of workers out on the Wildcat being at the bottom of the heap. They actually are better paid than some other workers in the mine. But you'd have a hard time making the argument that they're well paid.
25,000 workers, that's a lot of workers. This must be a huge industry in South Africa.
Look, Kathleen, platinum is the new gold. This is the booming part of the economy. It's the part of the story that links somebody sitting at home today in the United States with those workers on the ground in Marikana, which is that South Africa has 80% of the world's productive supply, is producing 80% of the world's supply of platinum these days. It's a scarce and precious metal that's used in everything from catalytic converters to electrodes to thermometers and jewelry. So it's a critical operation of the mines is a critical element of any plan to have economic growth in South Africa, but it also is a critical component in the global economy, and perhaps that's why what started as a localized strike with a relatively small number of workers has seized the world's imagination.
What do you think of the government's response to this strike? What were they thinking that they decided to open fire?
That's the subject of a presidential commission that began its work yesterday. I think there's if you look at the footage on the ground, as I have pretty closely ever since Thursday, it's very hard to make out exactly what happened there. It's hard to come away with the impression, any other impression than that it was a massive panic attack by the police who were there. They were under formal orders from the Minister of Police actually not to shoot live ammunition in cases of a protest like this. And if you listen to the sound, I don't recommend it actually because it reverberates in your memory for quite some time. There is just a barrage that begins at the point when part of the crowd apparently begins to come toward the police. And you can see the police backing away with semi-automatic weapons, just completing round after round after round in that direction. And, you know, as you know, 34 protesters killed at short range, 78 wounded on last Thursday.
This particular mine was owned by a London-based company, Lonmin, and I know there have been some calls as a result of this for nationalization of this industry. Is this common to have foreign companies operating the mines, and is this call for nationalization prevalent?
Yes, on both counts, international companies are heavily implicated in platinum mining. Lonmin, I believe these mines collectively are the third largest producers of platinum in the world, so they are big players. And the mine nationalization debate within the ruling alliance and within the African National Congress, which is the dominant political party in South Africa, has been hot and ongoing for the last 8 to 10 years.
Tell me a little bit. You spent a great deal of time, years as a matter of fact, talking with people on the ground, looking at the emerging generation, looking at the African National Congress, interviewing people who are the head of government, etc. Overall, let me ask you your general impression of whether or not things have improved, the daily life has improved since the African National Congress assumed power.
You know, that's a real tough one. Let me take a crack at it two different ways. Certainly, the one person, one vote that represented political liberation in 1994, the ascension of the first black president in the country, Nelson Mandela, improved life enormously in many, many realms that are important and that shouldn't be minimized. In addition to that, the ANC launched a series of programs to take care of immediate needs, people in hunger, people unhoused, and that sort of thing. The difficult thing for the ruling party and for the country has been that three things actually happened at the moment of liberation, because on the same day that democracy arrived in 1994, economic globalization and the HIV pandemic also marched in the door. So those are the constraints under which the government has tried to produce both economic growth and to narrow the gap between the rich and the poor. And on both counts, it's been a mixed record. Relatively slow growth 2 years ago after the financial crisis, negative growth, and rising inequality in a country that was marked by such severe inequality from the past. So these apartheid-era patterns of wealth, 10% of the population, mostly whites, continuing to hold most of the wealth and most of the land, coexists with a kind of political sense of political freedom. And I think there are rising calls for that political freedom to be matched by serious movement in the direction of economic freedom and social justice.
What about the response to the AIDS epidemic? You write about that, I know, in your book, or at least I've read that you've written about it. The book isn't out yet, that there has been a state indifference to public health crises like the AIDS epidemic.
Well, during the presidency of Thabo Mbeki, the current president's predecessor, of course, there was a deep division within the government about how to respond to the AIDS pandemic. Since President Zuma took office in 2009 and the appointment of a new health minister, South Africa in some ways has been model in its response to the AIDS pandemic, and under difficult circumstances has been making serious progress since 2009.
We are welcoming phone calls for our guest, and we'll take your calls momentarily. Our guest is the author of a yet-to-be-released, but we will talk to him after the book is out. It's coming out on September 5, Douglas Foster, author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. We are talking about South Africa, our attention drawn to that country after news reports yesterday of serious problems with the police firing on striking workers in South Africa. 34 platinum miners were killed when police opened fire during a wildcat strike. The London-based company that owns the mine threatened dismissal to any worker that does not return to work. There are miners who are awaiting trial, and it's all reminiscent to some of the days when the police of the apartheid government opened fire on protesters. So it's an ongoing story, and we thought we would draw attention to South Africa and look at what has changed in this country and what needs to be improved yet as a result of the ANC taking power, changing the country. But there are still problems. Here's our phone number. We welcome your phone calls always, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, or you can always leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming your phone calls at 800-486-8655. Douglas Foster is our guest. He is right now associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University and author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. 800-486-8655. We start our calls with Victor in Milwaukee. Hi, Victor.
Good morning. Good morning to your guest. I'm curious as what is the ethnic makeup of the police force versus the miners? Because knowing some of the political history of the ANC, they favored the Xhosa, and the opposition sometimes were the Zulus. And I'm looking to see, was that a bearing on it? And also, I picked up from the conversation there might be a disconnect between the old politicians versus the young politicians, because it seemed like there's a miscommunication between them, different expectations.
Victor, I think those are two really good questions. On the first one, the ethnic makeup of the police force, I don't have the exact proportions here, but I don't think that conflict between those who speak isiXhosa and those who speak isiZulu was a consideration in this case. There were four language groups, main language groups, among the strikers, and probably a similar makeup in the police force. But I do think the question leads to a pretty interesting thing. If you've been watching online any of the coverage, you'll notice the rising level of organizing, particularly by the wives and survivors of those who were killed, against the police. And the police force on the ground was largely black, but I heard over and over again in coverage in the last few days, women saying to interviewers, we are not going to give up. We are going to hit back because our people were shot by the Boer. And the Boer, of course, is shorthand for Afrikaans-speaking whites. So right across the color line, there was a reference that invoked this history of a largely white police force suppressing the legitimate needs and goals of a black population. So I think that is quite complicated, but I don't think it's influenced, from what I can tell, by any tensions between Xhosa speakers and Zulu speakers. With the other question, the generation gap, absolutely. We have a generation of leaders now in their late 50s, 60s, and 70s who have led the country for the first 18 years. These miners are largely young. They were addressed yesterday by the ousted former leader of the ANC Youth League, Julius Malema, who called on President Zuma to resign and said that the only reason that people were shot was because the National Union of Mine Workers has forsaken the need of workers and is in cahoots with the company.
Hmm. Is there any truth to that?
Well, here's the challenge. People came out of the anti-apartheid movement and out of the National Union of Mine Workers, and those former leaders are in every category of activity around the country. Cyril Ramaphosa, a former leader of the ANC, actually still on the National Executive Committee, is a mine owner who has a stake in this particular mine. And so I think Malema's opportunistic speech will strike a chord with people who say the government is now attempting to be an honest broker in a society where it promised to have a bias towards the poor and to the working class, and its interests are no longer aligned with the interest of workers.
Mm-hmm. And what about the strikers themselves? There were reports that police officers had been killed the week before. Were there incidents of violence?
Yes. Strikes in South Africa are marked by high levels of violence, and you can understand why. There's a huge reservoir of unemployed people, and if you are a worker going out on strike, you can be replaced pretty easily. So these are confrontational strikes. This particular strike was a wildcat strike, and there had been violence. There had been 10 deaths before this shooting last Thursday, and among those were security personnel from the mine. I believe one a policeman and a mining supervisor, if I've got it right.
Hmm. Kenneth, I'm sorry, we had the same question, Kenneth, which I just asked. I think that may have been yours, but you may have a follow-up. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello. What I saw was that there were, first of all, there were the policemen killed earlier, and then I'm sure the police heard a bullet flying, and then they opened fire. I mean, they were ready, and that's what I saw happen.
Sure. Well, that's that is part of what the Minister of Police has been saying. It's hard to hear in the coverage. It's hard to see in the video because the reporters who were shooting the scene were behind police lines. So you see it primarily from the police point of view. I think it's going to be hard for any commission of inquiry to reach the conclusion that with a small group of protesters running towards them, that they had to unleash firepower that killed 34 and wounded 78. But that's exactly what the Commission of Inquiry will be getting to, as well as trying to examine the underlying causes for the dispute in the first place.
And thank you very much for the call, Kenneth. Please explain to me, if platinum is the new gold, South Africa has a very, very valuable resource. Why is it so difficult to make sure that people who are poor in the country... and we've got this long history of racial isolation and extreme poverty. Why is it so hard for people to, in some ways, share the riches of that natural resource?
In particular, in mining, it's become less labor-intensive, more mechanical. So even as the tremendous platinum mining resources have expanded, or the mines have expanded, production has expanded, this particular mine had a significant increase in production last year that included speed-ups for workers. Even the salaries that these workers are complaining about are spread through a relatively small number of people. Also, the mines put up rapidly, a kind of frontier spirit runs through the communities that come into the towns that rise up pretty rapidly, and that is also a factor. The pattern of mining in South Africa was always one of the hardest and most difficult jobs being done by blacks who migrated from home and from their families. That's still largely true. So this is largely a male population, and maybe more confrontational as a result of that, not being rooted in longstanding communities and not being with their families.
Mm-hmm. You can't be in South Africa for any length of time without seeing how news is being reported. How was this news? And tell me about the general state of the press in South Africa, but particularly starting with this story, how were newspapers and television stations covering this?
I think they were all over it. For one thing, most of the major newspapers and outlets, broadcast outlets, and I would include in this BBC and Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera did some of the best work on the ground. So it was well covered. I think it was a difficult story to cover because the most militant protesters were on a hill called Wonder Kop, ironically enough, the Wonder Kopje. And they were largely cut off from reporters, so it was difficult for reporters to get that side of the story. But I think they acquitted themselves well, and part of the lively debate that's going on in the blogosphere and on the pages of most papers in the opinion section is largely over whether the strikers' demands were legitimate, the role of violence in the strike, and the role of the government and the police in needing to play an honest broker role. In this case, the police were essentially serving as strike breakers in an unprotected wildcat strike. So it's complicated in that sense.
And tell me about the people who are awaiting trial. My understanding is there are a huge number of people awaiting trial. They're being accused of what? How will they be tried?
They'll be tried in the local court. I think it was 39 were arraigned yesterday, 260 arrested. This will be a focal point for a lot of protest and a potential for making things even hotter in that area during a period where national and local leaders are hoping for things to cool off. They'll be charged with everything from riot to potentially some of them for the murders of the mining supervisor and some of the security personnel. So far, no policemen have been charged with discharging their weapons illegally or with murder. And that, of course, will be seen by the local people as a use of the courts to punish one side and
yes.
not the other.
Are there calls for policemen? There must be calls for policemen to be charged.
Sure. Among people on the ground, I haven't heard that from political parties. Julius Malema, the ousted youth leader, spoke yesterday. It wasn't among his remarks. So that hasn't emerged as a big demand yet.
The youth leader, who is Julius Malema?
Julius Malema was president of the ANC Youth League for several years. He's a former ally of the president's who fell out with the president, and he was expelled from the party, but he has continued to organize and to speak out. He said, among other things, yesterday, Zuma is not a president, and also Lon Min had a high political connection. That is why our people were killed. So in addition to leaders of opposition parties, Malema and other organizers have moved in to assert their solidarity with people on the ground.
And President Zuma, assess his leadership, please, Professor Foster.
Well, this couldn't come at a worse time for President Zuma. He's in a tough battle for control of his party. In December of this year, there will be an election within the party to determine the top six officers of the ANC, and that will tell us whether he's likely to continue as state president from 2014 to 2019, filling out the decade. He came to power promising to accelerate economic growth, railing against the way in which the party and the government had gotten disconnected from poor people and from the majority of South Africans. That was a critique of his predecessor, President Thabo Mbeki. And now, of course, he's being accused of the same thing. So he's in the middle of a political campaign to assert that he's the proper leader for the future at the point when his minister of police and his police force is under attack for having shot and killed workers protesting.
Hmm. Give me a sense. I've never been to South Africa, but I'm wondering, when you wander the area community to community, how much segregation do you see? Do you still see a lot of gated communities? Do you see a remarkable separation of races?
Apartheid patterns of settlement and housing really haven't been disrupted in a significant way since the political liberation in 1994. So people are quite segregated. I'm conscious, living in Chicago, of recognizing the ways in which we are quite racially segregated too. But certainly there are areas in the big cities, in Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, where people mix, particularly in the emerging middle class. There are over a million blacks who have entered middle-income sectors since 1994. So you see integrating neighborhoods and the emergence of a minority of people, but a significant amount of mixing in the workplace, in schools, and socially as well. But the country remains victimized by spatial apartheid, meaning where people come from, where they work and where they're housed, still highly separated.
Mm-hmm. And what about those horrendous slums that we used to see pictures of? Do those still exist? And would some of the miners who were on strike live in those kinds of conditions?
They're mostly living in shanty towns. As I said, many of these mines are new, and the towns that grow up around these mines have a kind of frontier spirit in them. A significant number of the miners will live in mine-supplied housing if they're single and working without their families with them. So it would be a mix. Some of those workers would be in the town. Some of them would be in dormitories, pretty spare dormitories, but significantly better than what people lived in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm. How is this company, back to the strike for a moment and the violence last week, how is the Lonmin, the London-based company, responding to all of this?
With a massive public relations campaign.
Really?
And with an effort to respond to the violence that's happened. They've offered counseling to employees. They're sponsoring a memorial service for those who lost their lives on Thursday, which is a national day of mourning in South Africa. And they are fighting hard to portray this as simply a fight between unions, between the National Union of Mine Workers and a newer union, the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union. They're positioning themselves as sort of in between and victims like everybody else of that fight.
Hmm. Let's go to Habu in Madison. Hi, Habu.
Yes, good morning and thank you. Just a couple of comments about what is going on in South Africa. Julius Malema is to the President Zuma what that upstart union is to the main the main union. If you get, I don't know what the names are, but I think NUM is the main union and the other upstart union. This is to be expected because what I see happening in South Africa is there is a big a rift between the haves and the have-nots, and really this is occurring worldwide, and I dare say in Wisconsin too, in India, in Chhattisgarh and what have you, where the majority of the people are living in almost dire poverty, never mind that there's no apartheid, but it is effectively, they are kept out of the mainstream, and there's a lot of problems that way that are bubbling up in South Africa from what I can read. So I'll just leave it at that, and thank you.
Thank you, Abu.
I think he's right about that, and it's complicated by the fact that politics and labor organizing have always been thoroughly enmeshed in South Africa in ways that might be hard for us to wrap our minds around. Militant strikes in the late 1980s, many of them led by the National Union of Mine Workers, helped make South Africa ungovernable and force the apartheid regime to the table to negotiate an end to that regime and to bring about a one-person, one-vote democracy. That's probably what makes government leaders very uneasy at night, to look back at that pattern, that historical pattern, and to wonder whether a similar kind of pattern may emerge now, where the feeling that these older union leaders and the more established unions have forsaken people on the ground. That is certainly what the appeal of the rock drillers was in their rhetoric and in their complaints. Mm. So I think he's put his finger on something important.
Give me a little bit more of the history of this, as Habu described it, this young upstart union, how recent it is, if their goals are slightly different from the older unions, the tensions between the two.
I think the main argument of this new union is that while leaders of the National Union of Mine Workers have been so active in the Labor Federation and so active politically and so involved in government, that the trade union needs, the narrow workplace organizing needs of workers has gotten second or third or maybe less attention. And so they've been making, they didn't spring up yesterday. They've been around lawnmen for a while. But they had taken up the demand of the rock drillers for higher wages in the last couple of years. And as a result of that, you had a situation in which the National Union of Mine Workers had the formal contract with the mine, but there was rising support for this younger upstart union, made up largely in the leadership of disaffected former leaders of the National Union of Mine Workers.
More phone calls in a moment if you'd like to join our conversation. Our guest this hour is the author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. The book has yet to be released. It'll be released on September 10, but we thought we would talk to him because he has spent a great deal of time in the country. The book is an on-the-ground narrative of the last 8 years as seen through the eyes of an emergent generation as well as the post-apartheid caretakers that they are about to displace. It's a changing of the guard. And our South Africa is experiencing a great deal of turmoil at the moment. Last week, 34 platinum miners in South Africa killed when police opened fire on a wildcat strike. The company is a London-based company, and as you can imagine, there are all kinds of ramifications of this kind of violent action, and we are talking about those this hour of the show. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. The email address is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation about this violence and these killings in South Africa, or about how the country has changed, the problems, the accomplishments 18 years after the end of apartheid. Tell me a little bit about, I'm very interested in your work on the ground, why you went to South Africa and all that you looked at. We don't have the book yet. We will soon and we'll invite you back. But what did you see and why did you go?
I went originally in 2004 with a group of students who work in South African media outlets for a quarter. And I thought I was going just to drop them off and to go on to the Democratic Republic of the Congo or someplace where some exciting conflict was taking place that I could cover. And I really simply just got hooked. I spent some time in the newsrooms. I began to think that something major was taking place both within the ruling party and among young people. So I began to look at the political schisms within the African National Congress that led to the rise of Jacob Zuma and the fall of Thabo Mbeki, kind of with half my time. And the other half of my time I spent with young people. Half the population is 24 and under. Had no direct experience with apartheid, really, have come up in the new dispensation, and have some militant and challenging ideas about the ways in which the country should change to serve the interests of young people. So it's kind of an upstairs, downstairs drama. That's what I hope I've produced in the book, of understanding what's taken place in the party that results in the kind of government in place and the kind of generational challenge that is coming up. I mentioned that three-quarters of black young black men, for example, are not employed in the formal economy. There's a huge number now who are actually coming through universities for the first time who can also not find work. So there's a challenge for the government and the society, both on the level of preparing people for proper work, creating a sense of social mobility, but then also delivering them once people have paid their dues and are prepared.
When you were saying that, I was thinking of the similar problems that we have with young black male unemployment in America. it's somewhat the same, isn't it?
Well, it's a little bit, though, like looking through the looking glass, because we're talking about a country in which 80% of the population is black. So there are these similarities that I think are useful to use, and then you have to kind of draw yourself up and do the reminder that that it's 80% of the population we're talking about, the vast majority.
You spoke with members of Nelson Mandela's family.
Yes, one of the I thread the narrative largely through the voices of six young people, and one of them is Mandela's grandson, Indaba Mandela. So I spent a significant time with him, partly because he's a compelling young person with a distinctive point of view, and also partly because he was living at the time in the home with Nelson Mandela. And it was a way, since Mandela himself had stopped giving interviews, to have a little bit of a sense of what that generational change within the family was.
Hmm. And what is the change?
Well, it's huge. You know, the Nelson Mandela grew up in rural Eastern Cape. He became an advocate in Johannesburg. He became a guerrilla. He spent most of his adult life, 27 years behind bars. Indaba grew up in Soweto, in the townships. He's a product of a cosmopolitan, urbanizing South African culture, and a globalized culture, in which he's working very hard in a foundation to improve the schools in Soweto. But he has a kind of sense of the global future of South Africa that is very, very different in his upbringing and attitudes than his grandfather, who he respects. He understands the history, but he sees the current South Africa as a place that his grandfather could scarcely imagine for all those years.
Yes. It would be hard to not respect that grandfather, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of interesting. The first time I got together with him, I said, "Who are your heroes?" And he said he named Martin Luther King and three or four other people. And I said, "What about your granddad?" And he said, "I can't think of him that way. He's right over there, you know, pointed over there." He said, "He's too close for me to see him that way."
Hmm. Let's talk to Mark in Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
I think this happening points out the need, and I'd like your reflection on it, the need for a middle class, for, you know, an educated middle class, for democracy to flourish. Without that educated middle class, it seems like people are easily brought into a radical, either left or right. And I fear for our own country, as I feel the middle class here is under siege the last few decades. Any thoughts?
Sure. There's a wonderful book by Don Peck, an editor at the Atlantic Monthly, about the coring out of the middle class in the U.S. And I think you're right to draw the parallels there. Certainly, rapid economic globalization of the kind we've had, and exacerbated by the financial crisis in 2008, has meant rising inequality everywhere. When you layer rising inequality everywhere over a society in which race and class were so tightly implicated, in which the vast majority held no material wealth, then you create the conditions, obviously, for a potential explosion. And maybe what we saw at Lonmin Marikana mine was a big warning about that. It's very hard for anybody to make the argument with somebody who is poor and protesting, has not had a measure of economic or social justice, that political liberation is enough, that being able to vote for your political leaders is enough, especially if you see your point of view is that that government is too far distant from the needs of people at the bottom and is serving the interests of your employer and not of the workers. Mm-hmm. So I think you're quite right. Rising inequality is the big challenge of our time. It's a universal challenge, and it's especially intense in a place where the inequality was so high, even when political liberation occurred.
And over the last 18 years, have there been successful attempts to address that inequality that either were short-lived or they are a part of changes since post-apartheid?
Yeah, I think you see it in the social protection network and the provision of food and the provision of housing and all those things. The difficulty is that that's largely a welfare net. It's not a economic growth strategy. And we have a world now where many of the big economic functions have been divided up. The Chinese are going to produce manufactured goods. The Indians are going to provide service. The Brazilians are going to provide agricultural products. And here in the U.S., we're going to borrow and consume. Well, that is obviously unsustainable, and it leaves no room in developing countries to maintain a manufacturing base, which is the primary avenue for social mobility everywhere. So I think what we're looking at with the Lonmin Marikana mine does raise all of these big questions about inequality and the creation of a middle-income class that people can reach from the bottom. That's the important thing. Social mobility has gone way down in this country in the last couple decades. There were some strides that were successful in South Africa from 1994 to 2000 and right beyond. And now, with the constraints of the global economy, it's been difficult for the government to make any progress.
Mm-hmm. Are the Chinese involved in platinum in South Africa?
Hugely. I think the big story in the next decade, and in the last couple of years already, we've seen signs of this, is a kind of competition between Europe, China, the U.S., and the rest of the world for these vast resources, many of them precious metals. So, yes, a huge race for control and ownership of resources all over sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm. And as this, let's go back to the violent story that we started the hour with and that caught our attention. Is this fraught with all kinds of possibility of further violence? It seems as though we're on tenuous ground here with so many people who have been arrested, with the police not being charged for their acts, with the miners being charged. I mean, how does this play out?
I think it's a huge problem for the government, and that's why you saw nine ministers of national cabinet basically moving to Rustenburg and taking up office there. A big chunk of the national government is there trying to respond to it. And of course, the threat, the volatility, is not just about what will happen there, but what those who are engaged in strikes in other parts of the country will take as the lessons of Marikana. Is the lesson that you cannot get justice through the normal means of negotiating with your employer, and can only get the attention of people and get your demands and grievances discussed if you cause a massive violent confrontation. I think that would be a really unfortunate lesson of this, but it could be that people in other parts of the country will say, I've been waiting for 18 years now. I'm not waiting any longer.
You think that's a natural outcome, that it'll grow?
I think it's a perilous moment in that regard. I think that the government could have some effect. There has been a massive, you have to call it a massive response. If you could imagine nine cabinet level secretaries going to a mining area in
really?
The U.S. in response to
right.
the strike, including the Minister of Mines, the Minister of Police, the Minister of State Security, and first among equals, the Minister of Home Affairs, Nicosizana Dlaminizuma. It's a massive response by national government. So I think what we're waiting to see in the next couple of days is if people see that as a real response, as an authentic response to get to the bottom of what happened and to fairly adjudicate and to press for changes in the way miners are paid and treated at that mine and elsewhere.
Thank you so much for the conversation. We'll look forward to receiving your book and talking with you in great detail about it in the weeks ahead.
It was great to be with you, Kathleen. Thanks.
Thank you. Douglas Foster, he is currently associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, formerly senior editor of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and he has written, and it has yet to be released, actually, but we'll talk to him more as soon as the book comes out, a book on South Africa. He spent 8 years doing reporting on this, what South Africa like since the fall of apartheid. But our conversation, prompted by the violence against 32 platinum miners who were killed last week in South Africa. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9:00.